Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, Director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. In this episode, we feature an interview with Cassandra Horry, Director of the Center for Teaching, Learning, and Outreach at the California Institute for Technology. Cassandra has been a friend and colleague of mine for years, and I was excited to talk with her about a couple of the EdTech projects her center is supporting at Caltech. Both projects involve making student learning visible in interesting ways. We spoke at the annual conference of the POD Network, a professional organization for people who work at teaching centers, like Cassandra and me. Cassandra, it's nice to be with you here at the POD conference in Louisville.
You too, Derek. It's great to see you.
We're here with a bunch of teaching center folks and folks who do educational development of all kinds. It's been a really great conference. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too.
I have. We're over 900 strong, and it's great to see this community grow.
Absolutely. And you had a little bit of professional news, I think, two nights ago in relation to POD. What is your new title?
I did. I am the president-elect, which means I will be president-elect in about March of 2017.
All right. So congratulations.
Thank
I was
you.
Very excited to hear that news.
I am so excited. I think this is going to be perhaps a much better 3 years for POD than 4 years for the nation, but we shall see.
Yeah.
In any case, we've got some really wonderful new directions to pursue.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your professional background and how you got to the position that you're in now at Caltech.
Sure. I'm a scientist by training, so my undergraduate background is in physics. And my graduate work is in environmental science. I did spectroscopic measurements of atmospheric trace gases. So I, along that academic route, had a strong interest in how the learning process was unfolding in the classes I was taking as an undergraduate and eventually teaching as a graduate student. And eventually those questions about how we do higher education, the processes underlying learning, and ultimately the processes that shape how our organizations function to support learning and how we think about teaching became very, very compelling to me. So I decided to pursue that direction along the way. I taught expository writing, first year writing, for several years full time to be able to learn more about other kinds of teaching domains that and methods that we don't use so much in the sciences, and then have worked in several administrative capacities leading and contributing to educational development efforts on different campuses.
Yeah, and then a couple of years ago, you got to go to Caltech.
Yes, so at Caltech about 4 years ago now, we started a new center. It's the Center for Teaching, Learning, and Outreach. And we work pretty broadly. We work with the faculty. We're working on educational innovation. We're redesigning courses and working with the institution on the curriculum. We're training the future faculty who are coming out of our institution, who are also often our current teaching assistants.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot with educational technology, so we're a primary office supporting online courses and massive open online courses and really helping the institution use educational technology well and think about its use and application. And we partner a great deal with our our IT type department and do that work hand in hand. So often we're at the table, IT is at the table, instructors are at the table to design an approach from the ground up that is clear about learning objectives and big picture goals and integrates across media, technology, and instructional approaches.
That sounds very exciting.
Well, that's the ideal.
Right.
That's what we try
right.
for.
Yep. Well, can you tell us about a few projects that you've been involved with in the EdTech realm?
Sure. So the ones that, when you asked me this question of projects that we might want to talk about, I thought of a couple, and then I was thinking about what unified the theme that made those the exciting ones to talk about for me. And I think that underlying theme is really those places where we have used technology to make thinking visible in a different way, right? Whether it's in the classroom frequently or in collaborative technology-enabled types of spaces, no matter whether they're while we're in person or asynchronously or at distance. So a couple of those in particular, I'll start with a really, really concrete one, which is a problem that maybe some other campuses face. We have some classrooms that are not as conducive to collaborative or active learning as we would like them to be, and increasingly as our faculty, our instructors would like them to be. And yet we can't magically wave a wand and make those change. So in some cases, we've been able to hack those spaces using really kind of cheap, not super high tech, but a combination of technology to transform what happens, even despite the kind of barriers that we have. In particular, a recent example is a class that was about numerical methods in chemical engineering, of all things. And the frustration that the instructor came with was about how to bring the complexity of the coding that needed to happen into this classroom, which was frustratingly fixed seat, and ultimately,
should I imagine a kind of traditional college lecture hall?
Please do imagine a traditional college lecture hall, and like many others on our campus, plenty of blackboard space. We've got 9 sliding chalkboards across
chalkboards.
The front of the room. Yes,
whiteboards, chalkboards.
In this case, chalkboards, which are a favorite still on our campus, and have their own wonderful affordances. And I actually wouldn't want to get rid of them, even if we took out all the fixed seats. But no, it's the fixed seating that was making it really difficult for students to work together. But as we talked with the professor, the real challenge was that that the instructor couldn't access how students were thinking, what they were doing. Right. He just couldn't see their computer screens, right? So he had tried having them bring their laptops into class, having some group problem solving, and it always devolved into each student alone on their laptop or a lecture, right? So he was really having trouble finding this middle ground. So as we talked about it and defined that problem along with really the learning objectives, which had to do with this kind of nimble thinking between that was able to transition between the chemical engineering and the coding, right? And the numerical methods and the techniques, but be able to kind of bounce back and forth and talk about those together. So so we came up with a solution. We were able to get a hold of a small set of very small micro projectors. So just a typical, like you plug it into your VGA outlet, with your dongle if you're on a Mac, and but they're very small, handheld. It's about the size of a Walkman if you're from the 90s.
Okay. I get that reference.
Almost a
small paperback book.
Thank you. All That's right. A better reference. A small paperback book. And they can clip onto the back of one of our beautiful fixed seats. In this space, we happen to have wall space that could be projected onto.
Okay.
So we were able to kind of cluster students around a wall with a mini projector, assign roles to the group work around problems. So you had the one student with the computer that was the projector. We also used cling sheets that, through static, just stick to the wall and create a whiteboard surface in multiple spots around the room. So we had then the student who was the whiteboard marker person who was charting the big ideas, the chemical engineering ideas underlying the coding exercise, so that those were displayed alongside the actual code and the results of running the code, and then the students who were contributing to that conversation and helping with the problem solving. So now we have teams, we have roles, and we've made the thinking visible. Yeah. And what the professor ended up saying about this experience, and really kind of did a brave thing to change course halfway through the class, having tried a few things, right? That's hard to do. But was just super enthusiastic and amazed that it was being able to see and intervene in those dual thought processes in real time that was the really exciting change that happened, right? So to be able to see maybe an error or a misconception in the chemistry, or in the engineering concepts.
Right.
Maybe an error or misconception in the coding, or a misunderstanding of how a packaged routine or some plugin that they were using was running, which was leading to a magnification of error or something like that. and being able to stop and compare those ideas right in real time.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah, we loved it too.
And right. So, I mean, well, and part of it is that on my campus, we have a lot of these very traditional lecture rooms.
Right.
And I'm always trying to think creatively about how to make them more active learning spaces. But I like the technology choice there, right? Some kind of high tech, some low tech.
Yep.
Right. But also the kind of process change in the classroom, right? The group roles and the ability for the instructor to circulate and interact and see the student learning. It's really powerful.
Well, and it was also fun to see what students did with the space. So we had some ideas about where they would put these, you know, visible learning kind of low-tech, high-tech kits around the room. And some of them threw that out the window and ended up clustered on the floor around, you know, a different spot in the room and using, you know, using multiple cling whiteboard sheets. Yeah. Overlaying the whiteboard sheet with the projection so that they can annotate
right?
the projection or the code
wow.
in a different way in real time.
That's great.
So it gave the students, I think, some agency to be able to use the tools in different ways as well.
Yeah.
So going forward, that's in place, and we've now packaged this this kind of active learning, visible thinking kit into something that instructors during other terms can use or might choose to adopt in different
mm-hmm.
ways.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, other projects? You
so,
said there were
yeah,
several.
Yeah. So that was one example. The other that we've done a little bit more rigorous assessment and study of is an online platform that was developed at Caltech. It's called SKIES. So it stands for SUCOM Intelligent Educational System. I might have to go back and look up what that means. So I might have to edit that out.
SKIES.
SKIES.
Okay.
So SKIES Learn, if you're looking for where that sits online. But it's really, the platform is one thing, right? But what it does is put a course or a session or a little part of a lesson into a knowledge tree format. And one that is accessible to all students at the same time with real-time updates. So again, we've kind of taken the thinking, which might be otherwise a linear set of slides or something like that, if someone's using technology to do presentation. And of course, there are lots of ways to make that non-linear and lay it out in different ways. There's Prezi, there's, you know, other methods like that. This one, though, because it has that real-time update and lets an entire class of students be either adding to the tree or responding to places in the knowledge tree.
So I'm imagining kind of like a family tree, right?
Imagine
where you have kind of branches coming out.
Yes, okay. Imagine a family tree.
Okay.
A little bit different than a family tree, you might imagine one primary kind of spine of knowledge that threads through, and that helps the instructor be able to lend a structure and an outline, a kind of scaffold to what might happen in the class or to a sequence of learning that's intended for the students. But off of that, yes, imagine that family tree structure. So at different places from that spine, you'll see one branch, maybe a question that a student asks, maybe a question the instructor poses that can then have multiple responses. Clicker type questions can be embedded.
So not
there.
Just kind of content,
not
or
just
visuals
content.
Or slides,
yes.
But questions and interactions and discussions.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So what the platform does is pretty flexible. I mean, like any technology, you gotta use it intentionally, right?
Yeah.
But some of the places where we've seen that really help are where the class, in a way, uses this knowledge tree as kind of a wiki. So at different points during an in-class session, the instructor might pause and ask a question and get students to, they might actually sketch something in their notebook in response, take a photo and post it.
Mm-hmm.
We've had instances where...
And put that in the knowledge tree.
And put that in the knowledge tree for everyone to be able to see. We've had instances where it's being used in like a lab or a demo type environment, and students can do a brief little experiment, desktop type experiment, record the results and post that for everyone to see. They might have different cases that they're applying, different test conditions, and be able to pull that knowledge back together. Or just a kind of conceptual question that goes in. But again, it's kind of with the instructor scaffolding, being able to see multiple students think, ask, answer, and contribute to that. And that there's a kind of motivation that we see in being able to contribute back to the class environment in real time, Yeah, as well as just access to different points of view, and a kind of peer teaching that can happen in answering other students' questions as well.
And it sounds like also this piece where whatever you're talking about now is connected to everything else, right? And so you can kind of situate this topic or this question in the bigger picture of the course.
Yes, yes. And being able to actually see how that fits together is we seem to find a pretty helpful thing.
Yeah. Let me ask an educational development question. For something like SKIES, that sounds like if I were to use that well as an instructor, I might have to make some big changes to my course. Have you found that to be the case? And if so, how do you help faculty navigate kind of how they change their own teaching when they start to use technologies in really intentional ways?
Yes, absolutely. And probably like many other educational developers, we always want to be driven by a pretty clear learning goal. Now, in reality, that's not always where people start. Sometimes people do start with, hey, there's this cool new thing. I think it might be useful. I want to try it out. And honestly, I think that's an authentic place to begin, and we don't like close the door on that beginning point. But I think we want to back up a step and try to clarify, you know, why this, what attracted you about this widget piece of technology approach, and offer some parallel potential solutions. So where we might have another tool with some similar functionality, but that might better meet the need, we'll put that in the mix as well and try to do some applicability testing. This is a little bit of maybe my personal manifesto about educational technology.
I would love to hear your personal manifesto.
I call it that in the graduate class that I teach about pedagogy, about teaching and learning in higher education, in particular in STEM fields. But, you know, first there's the goal, the learning goal, right? Maybe it doesn't come first, but eventually we want to be clear about that. There is matching the technology to the goal. And, you know, that can mean 9 chalkboards, right? There is a clear sometimes need we find, especially in derivation type problems, in very kind of logical things like mathematical proofs, where there is a thread of thinking that, I'm going to say it again, we need to have be visible all at once to students, that we can lose when we don't have the ability to spread that out over time and physically in the room over multiple chalkboards.
Yeah.
So there's a use for that. So that's the technology match the goals. And then these other pieces, I think, sometimes get lost, which is why it's part of my manifesto. But one is, how are you going to integrate it? So once you've chosen a piece of technology, can you clearly explain why you're using it to students, make time for that explanation to happen in the class, and build it in, weave it in to the thread of everything that happens in the course? So where does it show up in assignments? Where does it show up in credit or in assessment, whether that's just assessment for feedback, so formative kind of assessment, or whether it's into the grade for the class? And sometimes that's at a very low level if it's low stakes and it doesn't matter exactly what students say or how they answer, but that they're engaged. But that piece is key and often gets skipped. So we try to dwell on that piece as much as possible and provide people with some tools for integration. And so if I go back to our hacking the classroom example, one of the tools for integration that we helped with was a little laminated guide to group work that goes with every little projector. It's a half sheet, it's on bright colored paper, but when the student team gets that mini projector, they also get a group or team roles piece of paper.
Right.
On the other side is some tech support points for how to turn the projector on, but the group work guide goes with the projector for them to look at. And that's something the instructor said, I would never have thought of that. It's really great that it's here. Integration. But there's a fourth point to my manifesto.
Okay.
I know we're only supposed to have 3 in anything, but I have 4. And the fourth is that I strongly believe that teaching is a deeply personal act. It has to do with the self of the instructor, with being comfortable and confident. There's a kind of a communication approach that has to do with it. And I think if you or your listeners think back to any really memorable instructor that they had, that person's authentic self is a part of the picture, most likely, and a part of what makes them a memorable human figure that stands out. So we try to make this explicit with the folks that we're working with, that we're consulting with. If they've chosen a technology and have a goal and even have thought about integration, but the thing itself feels uncomfortable or just doesn't work for them, or it takes, you know, one too many steps, or they have to type in a way in front of students that they mess up and feel bad about, like, that's not going to be sustainable. So we want to do some actual, like, human testing in terms of usability and personal fit for any kind of application of technology, because when it just doesn't fit, it goes by the wayside almost immediately. Any kind of misfit gets amplified when we're in a classroom full of students in front of people. And likewise, I think if it's a good fit, that good fit could get amplified because there's a comfort there and a confidence that students will feel and sense and pick up on, and it will kind of be more open to adopting that as their own tool that they are feeling comfortable using as well.
One follow-up question. I do wonder, you've been at a few different types of institutions over time. Is there anything about the research university context that shapes how you work with faculty or how you think about technology?
Well, the research university environment, the environments that I've been in are strongly characterized by an independence and an individuality among let's call them principal investigators. I think that is the ethos that drives research forward, is that individual, or, you know, it's a group effort, it's a collective effort, but it's also not an entire school or department effort, right? It's got a local kind of environment to it. That really drives a lot. So perhaps a little bit unlike some other environments where there can be a kind of a one size, we're all going to use X. We have the one adopted technology for whatever the purpose is, and that's really institutionalized. At least in the environments I've been in that are characterized as high research, that just hasn't worked. As new solutions bubble up, people want to be able and have the freedom to try new things out. So it means for educational development, I think ed tech support, we have to stay nimble. We have to be willing to switch things around and try things out, be willing to up our expert game on any new things that are coming out pretty quickly, figure out their functionality, test them out, see if we can kind of break them from a learning perspective and anticipate what some of the problems will be. It also means that we have to be pretty modular, because there's not going to be one central place that for every class students will go to find the technology that they'll use. And sometimes our campus systems can't keep up with that. So not all of them might be integrated through the single sign-in system.
Right.
And there might be some actual security concerns that arise from that. So we have to have those conversations about what to inform students if we're going to use a third-party platform, about their passwords and their usernames, and making sure those are different from their university accounts, and thinking about what information they want to put there, and having instructors think about what information they need to be careful about putting on those kind of outside platforms. But we don't want to stop them from using them or trying them out.
Yeah, and there's a lot of creativity and kind of entrepreneurial spirit that comes there, right?
Yes.
And you want to foster that while also kind of providing the kind of support that they need.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it means it's pretty time intensive, right? To be driven by that sort of individualistic entrepreneurial spirit, and be able to kind of keep up with it. And we don't even try to pretend to get ahead of it, right? So, I mean, I thought about this early in our center's development. Were we going to have some dedicated time to scanning the environment and seeing what's out there, what's next? And it's turned out that that's not something we can do in a comprehensive way. We don't set aside time in our calendars to scan the environment and test new pieces, because they'll come to us when it's of interest. We're going to hear about it, and that's when we kick into high gear and figure out what it's all about, how to use it, and how to support it.
So the name of our podcast is Leading Lines, and we try to not predict the future of educational technology, but maybe shape it a little, or at least kind of talk about what we'd like to see there. So what are some things you'd like to see happen over the next 2, 3, 4 years in educational technology?
All right. Well, that's exciting to try to get to shape this. Let's see if it works. Shall we get back together in 3, 4 years and check it out? Okay. I think you'll have a blog post about that, I'm pretty sure, at some point. We were just talking about that kind of sense of being nimble and entrepreneurial and being able to follow the nose of something interesting, right? Follow the scent of a new possibility for learning. And from an instructor side and a kind of instructor-focused support side, we can figure out how to do that. I think that still poses some real challenges for the student experience side. We're a small enough institution that people can figure out who to ask and talk to their housemates or their roommates and try to figure it out. But I think in other environments that might be more difficult for students who are less familiar with how the institutional ed tech infrastructure works for some of the purposes. I think there will always be cases where there's a rogue implementation of a technology that we haven't touched and doesn't have the integration and the personal factor and the goals haven't been totally clarified. So it would be, I think, a dream for me and I know for colleagues on my campus to keep that nimble ability to respond and try new things, but plug it in a modular way to a more unified experience for students. And honestly, I don't know how that could be accomplished, but if our, for example, learning management systems themselves could be more nimble to be able to modularly plug things in, and I think in some sense they're headed in that direction, but to make that a little easier from the instructor side, to plug it in and have it be more seamless for students, I think that goes both ways, right? For the student to access where they need to go to do their learning, but immediately be able to see the tools that are at play in a particular learning environment. It also goes the other way, so to be able to have the student learning data come back into the central place or dashboard or system that instructors can access and fold it all together. So, yeah, that's my dream.
It's getting better, right? I mean, there is the kind of initial, like, hey, it's a kind of single sign-on kind of thing, and you can pass through authentication, but we're getting better tools for bringing the data back.
Okay.
I think what's a little bit challenging is there's still... So in that respect, I think some course management systems are starting to change in that they are kind of becoming this kind of connective tissue around other tools.
Yes.
And so I think we are heading in that direction. I do wonder about the students' kind of experience of that, though.
Okay.
Because there's still, I kind of sign in here, right? And now I have, for this course, these are the tools that are being used. And for this course, those are the tools. So there's an organizational piece there that I think is very helpful for students. But there's still, for every course, I've got different things that I'm trying to figure out and use and learn, right? And I think that piece is, and I don't know if there's a technology solution to that, but I think of these students who come to college and... Like, you know, I'll have my students blog, right? And usually 1 out of 15 will have any actual blogging experience,
right?
But I might have them use Twitter. I haven't actually done that yet, but I could have them use Twitter. And maybe a lot of them have Twitter experience, but it's not in any kind of academic sense.
Okay.
Right? And so I want them to do these very specific academic things with the platform, and they're used to using it for kind of pure social and entertainment purposes.
Right. So
in either
case,
whether they've never used it or they've used it in completely different ways, they've got to kind of figure out cognitively, like, what are the moves we're making with this tool in this course? And I think that's still a big challenge, and I don't know how to address that, but I think there's a kind of learning how to learn piece, learning how to learn with technology, maybe, that we haven't paid enough attention to.
Right. Well, I think that comes back to the integration piece. And perhaps a more controversial idea is whether those, and I love that you called it connective tissue, right? If an LMS is the connective tissue among these tools, if that connective tissue might have the intelligence to help the faculty member build the scaffold, right? If that connective tissue set up to really not just plug in the technology, but articulate the purpose of it. There still has to be a human articulating that purpose, but we can certainly structure the instructor experience potentially to prompt for that, to make it a clearer part of the process. I say controversial because I think some of the MOOC platforms have kind of moved in this direction from the course builder side. Uh-huh. There are now more evident checkpoints for incorporating learning goals and outcomes and having a kind of course structure that clarifies, you know, what the objectives are and how the pieces fit together. But they're working with a limited set of tools, and at times, at least on our campus, that has felt a little bit heavy-handed as well.
Yeah.
It has its own kind of marketing purpose to it.
Right.
It also
can teach a course on this platform, but it has to look like this.
Yes, but it also has that kind of a little bit of a cookie cutter feel to it, and it has it also has a different motive potentially than just teaching the students who are in the room. Right.
Yeah,
it has a kind of marketing reach. Just nothing wrong with that, but it raises these kind of questions about motives and conformity and freedom to do things differently. So there's a fine line, I think, between intelligent scaffolding and heavy-handedness that has to be navigated.
It also occurs to me that this idea that we can kind of make the kind of student experience a little more seamless, a little more coherent, a little more... I don't know that they'll get that when they leave us.
Yeah,
right?
That's absolutely
true. And so kind
of
the ability to kind of be in this new kind of professional environment and pick up a tool that folks are already using and kind of figure out how it's being used and how I can use it effectively, right? Like that's maybe a transferable set of skills that we can help our students develop. So I'm kind of torn between, again, kind of standardizing and making things routine, right? Because that makes some things a lot easier. But it also may kind of inhibit a certain skill development, whether we're talking about the students or the teachers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so we think along a continuum of expertise.
Yeah.
And, you know, in an educational setting, I think we want to build a scaffold that's a little taller and sturdier for earlier experiences and slowly dismantle that scaffold so that less and less of it is needed over time. I don't think a technology can necessarily do that for us, so we still need humans.
So I'm going to end with the question we ask all of our guests. We spend a lot of time talking about digital educational technologies on this podcast. What's one of your favorite analog educational technologies?
Ooh.
And you've mentioned a couple already.
I have. I do happen to really like chalkboards a lot. I like whiteboards, too. And I think there's something about the largeness of a surface that lets us play in a different way, that lets us lay things out flexibly, the ability to erase and reshape and reform and use color and to move through the space while we're thinking about our ideas. I think those are all powerful pieces of non-digital technology. That said, we also have had fun with those like cling sheets that stick to the wall and make it writable anywhere and temporarily.
Yeah. Well, and what I'm hearing, though, in both of those examples is not... I mean, when we think of chalkboards, we tend to think of the instructor using it, right? But there's no rule that says that has to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. And some of our most favored flexible kind of teaching spaces are ones with floor-to-ceiling chalkboards and couches. And there are places where groups of students are doing active problem solving with facilitated help of teaching assistants or learning assistants. And those are just beloved. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you, Derek. I've enjoyed it, too.
That was Cassandra Horry, Director of the Center for Teaching, Learning, and Outreach at Caltech. In the show notes, you'll find links to Cassandra's center, the SKIES tool she mentioned, and a few other resources. You can find those show notes on our website, leadinglinespod.com. We welcome your comments and questions there, and on Twitter, where our handle is @leadinglinespod. You can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or your other favorite podcast app. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. That helps other listeners find the show. Leading Lines is produced by the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Groff. Thanks for listening.